Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. This is Frank Gaffney, your host and guide for what I think of as an intelligence briefing on the war for the free world. We tap with regularity into the intelligence of a man who has it in abundance. His name is David Goldman. He is a columnist for the Asia Times. He is the author of How Civilizations Die. He is a pundit extraordinaire and always a welcome guest here. David Goldman, it's good to have you. Welcome back.
Frank, thanks so much for the kind words. Always a privilege to talk to you. Thanks.
The privilege is ours. David, there is high drama going on in Her Majesty's government at the moment, and I wanted just to take a quick stock with you as to whether it's clear what the way ahead is now for Brexit, I guess, most immediately, but for Her Majesty's Prime Minister, Theresa May. Do you have a read on what's taking place across the pond at the moment and its implications?
I think it's very clear that there's no consensus on one side or the other in the British body politic, which means that you have a fratricidal and potentially damaging internal fight, which makes it very difficult for Britain to navigate what is a treacherous problem of withdrawing from the EC. Theresa May was never for Brexit. She ended up becoming prime minister because the pro-Brexit people stood in the firing squad, stood in the circle, and they took each other out. The pro-Brexit types like Michael Gove or Boris Johnson, Dominic Raab, have not been able to assert themselves. So they've left a lukewarm pro-Brexit prime minister in, and now they're trying to shoot her in the back. So unless you can get a clear consensus and a strong British negotiating position, if they keep fighting each other, this is going to be very damaging to the British economy, and we'll see the pound continue weak and British equity prices continue weak, and it's a sad situation.
Yeah. Do you anticipate that the upshot of it all will be a hard Brexit, as they call it, without some sort of understanding with the EU?
That's kind of like suicide. There are always reasons to postpone it. A hard Brexit would be extremely disruptive. Remember that Britain's most important industries are all financial services, banking, insurance, brokerage, and so clearing, and so forth. And a hard Brexit would disrupt that seriously. It would cause considerable economic damage. So my guess is they'll step away from the brink, but one never knows.
Yeah. Well, the brink is looming. I think it's fair to say it's, I think, March of next year now. And David Goldman, let me switch gears. You have been trying to help us make sense of what seems to me to be a somewhat anomalous situation. The price of oil is declining rather dramatically at the moment, and yet there do seem to be reasons to be concerned that there may be undersupply, not oversupply, in the not-too-distant future with developments in the Middle East, notably with Iran and Saudi Arabia, and of course, there's a perennial problem of Venezuela's meltdown. Why is it that prices are plummeting? And talk a little bit about the liquidity risk aspects of this.
When you are worried about a prospective shutoff of supply, you buy oil and you store it somewhere, which means you borrow money to own the oil. You require your banker to support that. It appears that a lot of international banks, particularly European banks, are trying to reduce their footings, reduce their exposure, because they're having difficulty borrowing large amounts of dollars from American banks. And one of the reasons they're having difficulty is because their stock prices have crashed during the past year, partly due to the Italy crisis, partly for other reasons. So the danger is that there's a credit contraction in the banking system, not a crash in the 2007-2008 sense, but a squeeze, which makes it difficult for a lot of people to hold these hedging positions. And the hedges are being wiped out because the bankers are calling up and saying, we're cutting your credit line. And that's the kind of thing which can become a snowball effect. Prices drop, more people have to sell things, and so forth. It tends to lead to pressure on asset prices generally. And that's, in my view, a risk. I don't think we're in a good environment for risk assets at all. Oil is just an example.
Yeah. Well, and you've actually recommended that people sell U.S. stocks at this moment, which is a pretty serious flag on the play, as they say. Hey, but speaking of flags on the play, our friend Larry Kudlow took to the airwaves last week in what seems to have been a fairly direct repudiation of another of our friends, at least mine, Peter Navarro. Larry Kudlow, of course, being the president's chief economic advisor, Peter Navarro being his principal trade advisor and the architect of the so-called trade war with the Chinese. Walk us through what we think is going on in this regard.
Well, as you know, based on my trip to Beijing last month and numerous discussions with Chinese officials, I was convinced then that the Chinese were looking to get a deal with the United States and finding ways to appease President Trump. Since then, there have been many news reports basically with the same kind of information. Chinese stocks have done a bit better as a result. Peter Navarro is a symbol of American intransigence in trade negotiations with the United States, and the ritual humiliation of Peter Navarro at the hands of my old buddy Larry Kudlow, I think was probably a signal to the world and to the Chinese in particular that the administration was interested in hearing serious proposals. Not that the fix is in, not that a deal is done, but that the administration would like to hear Chinese proposals. And my guess is we're going to get something that looks like a framework for a deal at the Group of 20 meeting at the end of this month. Not a deal, but a framework for a deal, postponement of any additional tariffs, and a general sigh of relief, at least in the short term. Long term is a different issue, of course.
And when you talk about the ritual humiliation of Peter Navarro, this was an interview conducted on CNBC, and what specifically was the thrust of it?
Well, Peter Navarro had told Wall Street to keep its nose out of the trade negotiations and said they were not wanted. He said Goldman Sachs should take its money to Youngstown, Ohio, and help American workers and not to act like an unpaid agent of the U.S. government. Very harsh words.
An unpaid agent of the U.S. government, David Goldman, or of the Chinese government?
No, they were acting as unpaid agents of the Chinese government. That's what Navarro said. Very harsh words. Larry's response was he seriously misspoke. He wasn't speaking for the White House. He wasn't speaking for the administration. Very strong repudiation. So I think that is a clear signal that the Trump administration would like to see a deal. And there are two obvious reasons. One is the stock market has been weaker than they hoped. And one of the contributing factors to stock market weakness, though surely not the only one, is worries about the trade situation. And secondly, a lot of U.S. companies have been telling the administration that the tariffs are going to hurt them.
David, come back to us again very soon, if you would. Next up, Daniel Horowitz joins us. We'll talk about the old leadership of the GOP in the House of Representatives, now the new leadership. That and more, straight ahead.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
We're back, I'm pleased to say, joined by Daniel Horowitz. Daniel is one of the finest and relatively younger minds in the political firmament of the conservative movement these days. He writes a superb column, Conservative Conscience, with Daniel Horowitz at Conservative Review. He features prominently in CRTV. He is an essayist, the author of Stolen Sovereignty, and an extraordinary resource for those of us who care about freedom and our country's future. And he's always a welcome guest here. Daniel Horowitz, thank you so much for coming back on. Good to talk with you.
Great to be with you on this busy week.
It is a busy week indeed. And one of the things that makes it busy is that we have seen in the past 24 hours the Republican minority in the next Congress voting for their leadership. And I wanted to get your sense of what it means that it's basically the previous leadership, minus Paul Ryan, of course, who is retiring, but Kevin McCarthy has been named the minority leader for the Republicans, Steve Scalise as his whip. Gary Palmer, a good man who has been elected to the chairmanship of the Republican Policy Committee. What is the net effect of all of this as you see it?
Well, you know what? Stupid doesn't change, and neither do the ways of the Republican Party. You know, that's what we've learned. When the Republicans did this job to us the last time in 2006, if you remember the second term of George W. Bush, they expanded spending. They did nothing to promote conservatism. They grew health care. They adopted the Democrat premise on health care. Sounds awfully similar to what we're dealing with now 12 years later.
Which has contributed, it might be argued, to the rout.
Exactly. The very people that led to that. And indeed, what they did last time was just renominate the same leadership that got them into the minority for minority leadership. And what's funny is, I guess to put a bright, positive spin on it, at least last time when we had a conservative challenge to John Boehner in 2006 after losing to Pelosi back then, none other than now Vice President Mike Pence challenged John Boehner, and he only got 27 votes. So this time Jim Jordan challenging Kevin McCarthy got 43. So I guess that is some degree of progress.
But it isn't horseshoes, is it? He has still lost the majority.
Exactly. And the thing, Frank, is that Kevin McCarthy – presided over a GOP majority during the trifecta of control, when they also had control of the Senate and the White House. I don't think it's hyperbole to suggest that this was the most feckless GOP majority in the history of trifecta control.
Which isn't very long, to be honest. It's a fairly anomalous situation.
They pissed away their control. Anything good happened just by Trump unilaterally, executively. And remember, Republicans controlled the House for 20 of the last 24 years. They have done nothing with it. We've lost the sense of what it means to be a conservative. Well, all we think conservatism is now is letting out drug traffickers and violent criminals from federal prison. That's all they stand for. So this is really not good. And as far as Gary Palmer, he's a good guy, but history has shown the down ballot number four or five positions in leadership don't really matter. If you remember going back to 06, they gave Mike Pence the number three slot, and rather than him changing them, he kind of just got sucked in with it.
They call it growing in office in Washington, don't they, Daniel Horowitz? Let me ask you, Daniel, about that matter you just touched on. The president yesterday, as you know, full-throatedly embraced criminal justice reform, and specifically something called the First Step Act, which is expected to be taken up and evidently passed in the Senate and presumably shortly thereafter in the House of Representatives in the next few days. Remind us what's wrong with this picture. I'm taking a cue from a note that was just sent around that Van Jones, one of the hardest leftists in the country, was singing Donald Trump's praises for this act of bipartisanship. But your thoughts?
Yeah, Donald Trump has vacillated on a number of policy issues throughout his career, but one thing he's been consistent on was being tough on crime, law and order. He actually specifically militated against this very piece of legislation because half of it was originally introduced in 2015 while he was running for office. He said everything that I'm saying. He said that, you know, in federal prison, they're all violent drug traffickers. None of them are there for simple possession. They're all they all have a rap sheet for other things. That, you know, this is going to create more crime, that the racial disparity has nothing to do with drug laws, but with the fact that, unfortunately, a disproportionate number of blacks commit violent crimes, as well are a disproportionate number of them victims of those crimes. He literally said that stuff before. Just a couple months ago, he said these people should get the death penalty, and now he's signing off on a piece of legislation supported by Soros and that entire, I mean, the entire swamp, everyone from head to toe, that will retroactively early release and reduce sentencing. So both reduce sentencing on the front end, early release time credits on the back end for the worst drug traffickers and gun felons sitting in federal prison. And as you well know, only 10% of people in the national prison population are in the federal system. These are the worst of the worst, not state prison. There's a lot more to talk about here, but this is simply astounding. It's all coming from Jared Kushner.
Well, I have to say, it seems as though part of the problem, though, is that friends of yours and mine, conservative movement leaders, in fact, are throwing in behind this thing as well. How do you explain that, Daniel?
You know, it's remarkable. You look at people our entire careers that work together with us on this issue, and within 3 months, they're bought off. The reason why I say bought off is because there's no such thing as a conservative donor anymore. They're all libertarian. It's either the Koch world or people tied into that world or other people, and they all get money from them. And moreover, I mean, you don't need to speculate. You look at a guy like Chuck Grassley, the chairman of the Senate Judiciary Committee. I have an article out at Conservative Review giving a synopsis of 10 different speeches he gave just a couple years ago, actually being more articulate and on point than I am on this issue. He deracinated every single premise of this bill. And yet, within a period of about 6 months in 2015, he went from speaking out against it and ridiculing every provision and every philosophy behind it to being on board with it. So you tell me what's going on. But, you know, this is the swampiest swamp issue of all time.
And Daniel, I just want to say, there is nobody who writes more voluminously or with greater clarity and effect than you on all of this issue. So when you say he did better than you, that's really saying something. Let me turn to another matter that is also of concern to both of us, related to all of the phenomena you've just described. President Trump said he was not going to sign another dang omnibus bill. It certainly sounds as though that's precisely what's going to be served up to him in the next few days, if not certainly weeks. What's up with that?
Well, what I think he really meant is that he said this last March when he signed the omnibus, but it wasn't just the process of the omnibus. It was what he was saying is that basically, even though Republicans control government, they had their lunch money eaten. In other words, every Democrat priority was funded from Planned Parenthood to Obamacare to Dodd-Frank, but it was also all of the accounts that Trump promised to cut. If you remember, the president at the beginning of a fiscal year introduces his budget blueprint. He doesn't control it. Congress does, but he, you know, gives his sense of his budget request, and they humiliated him by taking every account he wanted to cut, and they increased it, except for the areas he wanted to increase spending for the border wall and more ICE agents. And yet he signed it, and he promised he wouldn't do it again, but then he did it again in August, at least with a continuing resolution. So now you have December 8th is the last budget deadline that Republicans will have controlling all three branches. It's very clear. I mean, if you want to cut spending and if you want to fund our priorities in immigration while defunding sanctuary cities, this is the time to do it. The president needs to understand the four-letter word, veto.
Right. He has not exercised it once since he became president. And I think you're absolutely right. The quality control that's so needed here, especially with the leadership we've got, is sorely requiring a veto threat, at least, if not the actual exercise of it. Hey, before we run out of time, Daniel, you've written the book on stolen sovereignty. What is happening as courts egregiously overreach their authority to infringe upon presidential powers and to otherwise negate the Constitution? Talk about this in connection with what's going on with respect to, oh, there's so many examples, but most immediately, perhaps we could discuss the elections and what the courts are doing in that domain.
Sure. So the most fundamental question that is troubling our constitutional republic is who gets to decide the Constitution. The right answer is all three branches together with their respective powers push back against each other, and the body politic ultimately decides. As a nation, we all say, hey, this is not constitutional. We have elections, and you know, different things determine that. The legal profession has created this fiction that the judiciary stands atop the food chain. The unelected weakest branch of government is the strongest branch, and they are the sole and final arbiters, expositors of the Constitution. Now that would be bad enough if we all kind of agreed on the Constitution as it was mainly, except they agree what's in the Constitution is out and what's out is in. So the problem we have now is not only are they nullifying the purpose of elections by determining the outcome of every policy issue, they are now making it that Republicans can't even win an election because they're determining the outcome of the election itself on behalf of Democrats. What happens is states have election laws. Constitution, 17th Amendment, Article 1, Section 2, Article 1, Section 4 give states almost full authority over the times, methods, and procedures and qualifications of elections. You know, you have to have standards, you know, what type of ballots, the timeline.
Who gets to vote?
Exactly. States have that power. Congress has a small avenue to get involved, not the federal courts. But the courts read everything in the Constitution that says Congress. They read the judiciary. Very convenient. So basically, they are now nullifying a bunch of state laws after an election. Imagine, as Marco Rubio said in his analogy, you have a team that kicks a game-winning field goal at the end. They were down 28-26, kick a field goal, they win by a point. And then after the game, the referees say, you know what, we're now going to say that a field goal is worth just 1 point.
Yeah, that's unbelievable. Daniel, your analyses of these matters is absolutely superb. And your visiting with us from time to time is deeply appreciated. I hope you will come back to us again in the very near future. Next up, Arthur Herman joins us from the Hudson Institute. Straight ahead.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
We're back. It is my distinct pleasure to say, joined by a man I've admired for a long time and have spoken with from time to time, but not in a frightfully long time. His name is Dr. Arthur Herman. He is a senior fellow at the Hudson Institute. He is a prolific writer, analyst, commentator on matters involving all manner of national interests, but of particular importance to our audience, of course, his insights into national security-related U.S. interests. He is the author of nine best-selling books, including most recently 1917, Lenin, Wilson, and the Birth of the New World Disorder. It is coming out in paperback this week, and it will be required reading for all of us, I hope. Arthur Herman, welcome back. It is so good to have you with us at last. We have been wanting to talk for some time. It's good to have the chance. Thank you for taking the time.
I'm delighted to do it, and I'm looking forward to our conversation.
Good, as have I been. Let me start with a topic that we've been trying to focus a bit of attention on here for the past few months. And invariably, those we talk to about it refer to some of the seminal writing that you have been doing, I think now several times, on the subject of 5G at Forbes magazine. And I'd like to spend most of our time with you today talking about that, because I think you've certainly persuaded me, and obviously lots of others as well, that this is of surpassing importance to the future not only of telecommunications globally, but really our national security as well. Tell us a little bit, if you would, about what's at stake here with this so-called 5G revolution, Arthur Herman.
Sure. The first thing to note about it is that there's nothing particularly magical or significant about the name 5G. It's not a particularly new technology. 5G simply means fifth generation after the 3G and 4G, which was the advent of wireless technology, the technology you and I use all the time when we're on our cell phones and when we are downloading apps and checking on the internet. All that's made possible by wireless technology, all those towers you see scattered about on the landscape. Well, what 5G, the fifth generation, is going to do is it's going to back up all of that wireless service with an extensive fiber optic cable, which will mean that the level of bandwidth that we'll have access to through our phones and through other devices is going to expand almost exponentially. And what it'll make possible is to run multiple bandwidth uses at once so that you will have not only greater versatility of the kinds of applications to be able to do almost simultaneously as a result of these new networks, but you'll also be able to do things at incredible speed. I mean, we're talking about downloading movies in a matter of seconds. We're talking about a huge amount of data that will be moving around on 5G networks almost at the blink of an eye. And that, of course, is a big breakthrough from a commercial standpoint, which will enormously expand the number of users involved with this. It's going to make possible what we call the Internet of Things, the whole range of daily devices that are going to be hooked up to the Internet and have access to Internet data and to control via the Internet. We've already seen that with things like smart thermostats, voice control for a whole range of other appliances. But the expansion of this in ways that we can't even really imagine over the next couple of decades, all made possible through 5G networks. That's the good side.
Right, and the not so good side is what I want to visit with you about. I may be a Luddite on this, so forgive me for even asking the question, Arthur Herman. But there does seem to me to be an enormous potential for disruptive action, and well, even the takedown of our country if everything is hooked up. I mean, literally everything, the Internet of Things and more is hooked up to a 5G system, especially if that 5G system is in unfriendly hands. And that brings us to a very important part of the work that you've been doing. Tell us about the threat that might be resident in this new technology.
Sure. That's the crux of the issue, because the country that has leapt ahead in terms of getting contracts for installing and running 5G networks around the world, not the U.S. And not Australia, but including many of our allies, happens to be China. And China has managed to establish the lead in this race towards 5G in a couple of important ways. The first is that 5G networks, all that fiber optic cable that needs to be laid down to run it, is a big expense up front. It's a capital-intensive enterprise involving billions of dollars. And what the Chinese have offered countries around the world and telecommunication carriers has been the ability to get all of that system, all that network built at almost below cost prices, with Chinese help in laying out the infrastructure and with Chinese financing backed by the Chinese government.
This has been called by some the Digital Belt and Road Initiative as a kind of parallel infrastructure to the physical one that they've been building around the world.
That's right, Frank, and you're absolutely right. If your listeners are aware of the One Belt, One Road initiative that China is building to develop this physical infrastructure that links China and makes it the center of the world, extending through Europe and the Middle East, even into Africa and across Asia, of course, then 5G network will provide the digital version, the wireless version of that kind of network, with Chinese companies supplying the hardware, Chinese companies installing the hardware, offering the software in which to power these systems, and therefore having enormous access and control over who uses the internet, who uses 5G, and who's able to benefit from its uses. And among those users, your listeners should know, Frank, is going to be our U.S. military.
Yeah, well, this is where I wanted to go with you. But before we do, just very quickly, Arthur Herman, it has been said that this hookup to all of that digital infrastructure and technology and software and so on is essentially irreversible. That it's a kind of permanent dependency on China that it will be extremely difficult, if not effectively impossible, to extricate one's nation from. Is that your reading of it as well?
Well, I think there's the danger of that. Because since we are talking about fiber optic networks, and since we are talking about big construction projects and then laying out the hardware that's going to power these 5G networks, if you want to get the Chinese out of your digital air later on, it's basically a kind of rip out and replace process. And that's going to involve extra billions of dollars that most countries, understandably, are not going to be interested in doing and taking care of. So what you're going to have is a situation right now, from where we sit, where if we are going to keep the world from becoming basically subject to Chinese will and Chinese financing for the future of wireless, then we've got to move fast to, number one, stop other countries from participating in the Chinese 5G sweepstakes. And right now we're up to about 62 countries. So Latvia is the most recent addition to the list, but the UK, three UK companies have signed on, Ireland has signed on, Germany may be next. And then number two, we need to start getting our act together in terms of providing leadership in 5G technology and saying we have a better plan, one which will be, which won't involve the kinds of risks that are involved in having China run this system, and it will instead be one that will be open and available to all, like 3G and 4G have been as legacies.
Yeah. This is where I wanted to go with you, and we only, alas, have 2 or 3 minutes left with you, Arthur Herman, but just for the present conversation at least, let me put the question to you directly. You've persuaded me, and I hope our listeners, that having the Chinese in our knickers, if you will, running this 5G system, including perhaps one that is something that the Defense Department of the United States might ultimately be dependent upon, is a very bad idea. Declan Ganley, a man I think you know, a great admirer of yours, as am I, was on the program recently telling us about the imminence at which point this may become effectively irreversible, perhaps as soon as the end of February of 2019. It makes a very, very important question very urgent as well, and that is, what do we do about this, and how do we go about doing it?
Well, you know, if you know Declan, you've got him on the show, he has a plan that involves changing the ways in which spectrum is allocated in this country. That will, he hopes, bring about changes and rethinking about working and cooperating with China for the countries and for those who are doing the co-financing for all these projects and what's involved with it. Now, he may well be right, but I think there's also enormous, even if we don't go to the kind of open access model that he and others are advocating, I think there's plenty of room for the U.S. to sort of say, we are watching what's happening and taking names. And what we're going to see is, if you're going to continue to pursue this direction with China on this, there may be repercussions from the point of view of what kinds of technologies we're going to share, particularly ones that will reinforce those wireless networks going forward. And there are national security concerns that we have that we're going to put some responsibility and accountability on you. The second thing, Frank, is that there are plenty of allies, especially in Asia, who are waiting for a chance to partner with the U.S. on this 5G network and what takes place going forward. You've got Taiwan, you've got Japan, you've got South Korea, who are looking for U.S. leadership, as the rest of the world is, as usual, for us to point the lead, and then they will follow.
Arthur Herman, we are out of time to discuss exactly how we do that, but I hope we might visit with you again in the very near future. Diana West is up next, folks, right after this.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
We're back, joined as we have the privilege of being each week by the fabulous Diana West, longtime syndicated columnist, blogger par excellence, author of 2 best-selling books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. You can find her writings frequently at places like the Daily Caller, but always at dianawest.net. Diana, it's good to have you back. Welcome.
Yes, thank you.
Where to begin? There seems to be much mayhem afoot in official Washington these days, and you keep your eye on it better than just about anybody. Let me start with this, well, spectacle, I think is the right word for it, especially against the backdrop of your analysis of a society, certainly of a leadership culture that has witnessed the death of the grown-up. Talk about Jim Acosta of CNN and the fact that he is now suing the White House and numerous officials of the government over the fact that they decided, I think, frankly, that his decorum was so execrable in the recent press conference, including hitting a young intern on camera, no less, that, you know, we have really seen the death of the grown-up in operation in this case. Talk about it, if you would.
Yes, yes, I will. He laid his hand upon her. But yes, it is a matter of decorum. But the death of the grown-up story here is actually not Jim Acosta. It is his parents, if you will, at CNN. It is the boardroom. It is editors. It is the structure, the institution of CNN, now joined by many other such grown-ups and parents of these reporters, if you will, in this lawsuit against the White House, against President Trump, and various members of the administration, including the Secret Service officer who actually lifted Acosta's hard pass to the White House. Now, what I mean by that is that it is one thing to have somebody act up. And this is, I mean, this is a long case of Acosta turning the whole concept and practice of journalism into a narcissistic showdown with the president or the spokeswoman each time he appears, a debate rather than a question and answer period, an argument, and quite obstreperously so, as we all saw in the most recent example. But the idea that he is not being corrected, not being at least reassigned, not being at least given a time to cool off, let alone fired or given a new profession, perhaps, is really where you get to the death of the grown-up, because you have the superiors, his paymasters and others, actually taking his side. And that's where you really see the destruction of any sense of propriety, any sense of decorum, any sense of correction and all the rest of it that goes into this concept of our society being plagued by infantilism, being plagued by this kind of spoiled brattiness that now is actually going to court. And it will be very interesting to see what happens on the bench. You know, we can't assume that the courtroom will have any other adult officers at this point either. So that's kind of where we are with this.
I gather that they did draw apparently a Trump-appointed judge, however, so hopefully he will provide a bit of adult supervision to all of this.
It would be a marvelous experiment, actually, if President Trump did go through with this idea of changing the way the White House press corps functions, which is to say, not making it into this rarefied elect that only certain people can enter the White House and ask the president questions. Perhaps it should go on a lottery with the press corps generally, with all reporters who work in Washington, whether they come from the giant media organizations or some of the more serious internet sites as well, in terms of maybe a lottery that allows a certain number of people to ask questions who attend maybe in a larger venue. Certainly, I noticed the very first press conference which was given by President Eisenhower was not in the White House at all. I think it was across the street in the executive office building, if I'm not mistaken. So, I mean, there are different ways to have the president answer questions, and it is not a First Amendment issue as they're trying to make it, and that's the most ridiculous piece of this. This is just simply a matter of controlling the infantilism of certain members of the press corps and their bosses.
Yeah. I have to say, I feel a certain degree of misgiving about the government controlling the press, and I think all of us would. On the other hand, I do think, and this is where the, you know, your insights from Death of the Grown-Up are so important, that we've watched the dumbing down, I guess is one way of putting it, the infantilization of our official activities, not just, you know, our personal conduct, but what we do, what we witness people like Jim Acosta doing day in and day out. And as you say, without any apparent exercise of adult supervision, if you will, discipline, responsible behavior on the part of his superiors. And what this says, if it's allowed to persist, I mean, taken to its logical extreme, you can have the resistance in a much more unconcealed manner in the room. You can have Antifa in the room. Everybody has, you know, the right to behave as they wish in the presence of the presidency. And it just seems as though that's not right. It's not what we as a society require in the way of, well, basic decorum and public and personal comportment.
Well, that's true. And, you know, just this week also, there was a terrible example of exactly what you describe on Capitol Hill at House Rayburn office building at a meeting hosted or a public session hosted by Representative Paul Gosar. Daniel Pipes was there. Some of our European friends, Tommy Robinson, was piped in because he couldn't get his visa in time, apparently. And it was completely disrupted by Antifa-like protesters who did not who just started shouting and calling everyone a racist. And it, frankly, it wasn't all that different from what we've seen recently at the White House press corps. But it's that same idea that there is no longer an effort to have a fair and free exchange of ideas on any number of platforms and venues. It is all about muscling in a narrative.
Or simply suppressing a narrative. This is as worrying as anything, is that it is all about preventing any narrative with which these obstreperous types disagree. Hey, speaking of all of this, Dinah, I just wanted very quickly, you've written a bit about Michelle Obama's new, well, I guess, memoir, autobiography, whatever one wants to call it. Is it overstating your assessment of it to suggest that, well, this term is overused a lot, I think it's fair to say at the moment, a dog whistle to the resist Trump movement?
Well, certainly her rollout would fall under that rubric. I have not read the book. I've only read about the book. But yes, it is a, again, kind of a muscling in of narrative, again, directed at resistance types and Democrats included. I was completely kind of frustrated to see the repetition of the narrative on the Obama eligibility issue, which is something you and I have talked about in the past, to be converted into a matter of bigotry and racism. In other words, to question natural-born citizenship, presidential eligibility, the documents President Obama presented to the public, etc., is bigotry and racism. And she actually turned it into a weapon against Donald Trump, who actually came about 3 years late to this particular party, not criticizing him for it, but he got involved in 2011, whereas these questions began as soon as Barack Obama began to run for president in 2008. So yes, these are dog whistles, but they're also efforts to seal up this territory, to make sure that nobody crosses it again for fear of being tagged a racist, etc. So in that sense, it's like a dog whistle to dog whistles, and very damaging, very harmful. And as a result, I actually put up a collection of my columns called Remember When Obama Wouldn't Show ID, just to put it out there for the record that, no, there were a lot of complicated, fascinating legal issues and important questions that went right to this, what I concluded was a fraud perpetrated by President Obama on the American people that has yet to be examined fairly.
Well, this is a subject for a further conversation. I'm sure there will be people who will seize upon your reasoned comments and the factual basis for them that you have put into play by pulling them together for people to review at their leisure at dianawest.net. But since Barack Obama's wife is putting this ball in play once again, it does seem to me as though she's made it fair game for further analysis and evaluation. Objectively, not from a racist point of view, not from a bigoted or hate-mongering point of view, but just the facts. Diana, thank you so much for all that you do and your contributions to this program in particular. Come back to us again next week. I hope the rest of you will do the same tomorrow. Same time, same station. Until then, this is Frank Gaffney. Thanks for listening.
You've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.